This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 26th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. Today, we're flicking through the pages of a few non-fiction releases with journalist and bookworm Mark Mason. We'll be talking biographies, one of the scandalous tale of British politician Jeremy Thorpe, and the other one of America's favourite entertainers, Bob Hope. And we'll discuss 2,500 years of keeping fit in your new book all about the history of the gym. That's all to come here on The Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome, Mark. Great to have you on the show as usual. Well, let's begin with our biographical releases. First, I know you want to talk about Jeremy Thorpe, Michael Block's take on a rather eventful life of the man who was the leader of the Liberal Party here in Britain in the late 1960s. And I think we should explain that, you know, he had a colourful life that even ended up in a murder trial.
In a conspiracy to murder trial, yeah, it was an incredible story. He was the leader of the third biggest party in this country, the Liberal Party, and he'd been a big hero. He'd rescued them from virtually going out of existence, with the Tories and Labour being the two main parties. And he was a huge star. He was one of those flamboyant politicians. He used to wear a trilby. Every politician needs a gimmick, and he had a particular sort of hat that he used to wear, and he used to go vault. He had a rural constituency out in the countryside, and he used to vault over gates when he was out campaigning during election campaigns. Very witty, very flamboyant. But before he became Liberal Party leader, when he was still in his 30s, he'd grown up, he'd always been gay, and he'd had lots of gay affairs. And this was at a time when it was still illegal to be gay in Britain. And he'd had a short affair with a guy called Norman Scott, who then went around for years telling people that he'd had this affair with Jeremy Thorpe. And so now we're into the period when Thorpe's become the Liberal Party leader, and, you know, nearly went into the cabinet. There was an election where the Tories didn't have enough votes, and Thorpe might have been offered a seat in cabinet to form a coalition. And Scott's still out there telling all these stories. And Thorpe was getting more and more stressed about it. And the irony is, looking back on it, and this is what the book tells so well, it sort of weaves through. The most famous thing about Jeremy Thorpe is the Norman Scott case, is the gay affair, and what came from it. And Michael Block brilliantly weaves the two stories together, you know, his conventional political career with this story that was getting bigger and bigger and was going to ruin his career in the end. And, you know, in the mid-70s, it got to the point where Thorpe was so stressed about it that details have never been proved, and he was found innocent at the trial for conspiracy to murder. But some friends of his recruited a hitman who went down. Well, it was so comically inept. One of those stories that if you put it in a novel, no one would believe it. The hitman was so comically inept that at first he went to Dunstable instead of Barnstable, two towns that are hundreds of miles apart, just because one of them sounded similar. That's where he went, first of all. Then the hitman got Norman Scott and his dog out alone on a remote moor down in Devon. And the first bullet he used to kill the dog, and then the second bullet he was going to use to kill Norman Scott. And the gun jammed, and so Norman Scott lived to tell the story. It's an absolutely unbelievable tale.
It's an amazing tale. And I guess, you know, if it hadn't ended up in this trial, we'd have been a bit more sympathetic about a man who felt he had to hide his sexuality at a time when being gay was illegal in Britain, and a man whose thrill of kind of gay sex as well at that time was also part of his character. But what does Michael Block make of the man? Does he present him in a sympathetic way, or does he present him as a bit of a reprobate?
Oh, no, he's broadly sympathetic. And as you say, it's you know, it'd be hard to be anything else. I mean, Thorpe was growing up in a time where it was illegal until Thorpe was born in 1929, and until 1967, it was illegal to be gay in this country. It was illegal to have gay sex. And so he grew up with that as the background to his life. You know, he'd never... All his gay affairs had been completely consensual. There was he was never an unpleasant guy. It was just that he happened to grow up at a time when it was illegal to be gay. And the irony was that people, even at the time, his fellow politicians and journalists at the time believed that as well, because journalists had been offered this story for years and years. and didn't do anything with it because they said, you know, broadly they were sympathetic to Thorpe. It was only when Thorpe reacted to the fact of the gay lover being out there by trying to have him killed, that's when it became a story. So the irony is that if Thorpe hadn't reacted to it in the way he did, he'd probably have been okay in the end.
But tell me what he thought was the legacy in politics for this man. Did he think he was, you know, perhaps foolhardy in his private life, but actually quite astute in his political life?
Oh, absolutely astute. Yeah, I mean, certainly people disagree with him, but that's part of politics. In terms of his, you know, his results on the pitch, if you like, in the terms of the scores that he achieved, absolutely, he was a complete star. The Liberals nearly went out of existence in the 1960s. It got to the point where their annual conference was just a bit of a joke. They'd lost virtually all their MPs. And then through the late 60s and into the 70s, it got to the point where Thorpe had increased their number of MPs to the point that in the 1974 election, the Tories didn't quite have enough seats on their own, enough MPs on their own to form a majority. And it got to the point where Thorpe was in number 10 with the then Prime Minister, Ted Heath, talking about, you know, offering a coalition. And if those talks had gone slightly differently, Thorpe could have been in the cabinet. You know, there was thought that Heath was going to offer him Home Secretary or something like that, a post in the cabinet. So there's absolutely no doubt that Thorpe was a massive political star. It's his private life that makes the book just such an incredible story.
Well, that's the biography, Jeremy Thorpe, which is out now and it's published by Little Brown. Now we're going to move on to another biography, but this time of one of America's most loved entertainers, Bob Hope. This is Richard Zoglin's new book called Hope, Entertainer of the Century. Now, looking at some of the reviews of this, I guess that people are a bit kind of torn because while he was one of the biggest entertainers of his time, he doesn't seem to have survived very well since then. You know, his films don't quite stand up. His humour doesn't quite stand up. Is that a difficulty for this book?
Absolutely. I'm afraid it's a massive difficulty. It's one of these books that, to call it Bob Hope, Entertainer of the Century, and then in the introduction, the author says he said there's no doubt that Hope was one of the most important entertainers of the century. You could say that even that he was the most important, the only important entertainer of the 20th century, which is such a ridiculous claim to make. You might possibly be able to make that about Elvis Presley, although even there you would look ridiculous. You know, there are the people on the Charlie Chaplin, Sinatra, Elvis level. And even those, you can't say any of them were the only important entertainer. So to make that claim about Bob Hope, who, as you say, hasn't aged that well, you know, his films haven't aged that well and his comedy hasn't aged that well, it's one of those books that sets itself up, I'm afraid, for a massive fall. And it's a 486-page fall. There's a little bit of interest in there. You know, he was... It's and again, the stuff that is of interest doesn't paint Bob Hope in a very nice light. He was womanizing the whole time. He was mean. He once gave a family member a bill for a $3.75 phone call they'd made while they were at his house. You know, he was guarded, very guarded, always kept himself very private. And I'm afraid the biography hasn't dug around and found that much new. It's one of these things where if the biographer had written a story and said, this guy was a big, important entertainer, he conquered vaudeville. He then, when films, you know, Bob Hope was so old that he was starting off when there was only vaudeville, when Hollywood didn't really exist as an industry, certainly in the way it does now. So then Hollywood came along and Bob Hope conquered that, and he conquered radio as well. And his shows used to get tens of millions of listeners at the time. If the biography claimed, you know, he's important, let's have a look at him, you know, it could be an interesting story, then you would be more sympathetic to the book. But to make that claim about being the only important entertainer, and then to back it up with a book that doesn't really give you that much of interest, I'm afraid it doesn't really work.
Do we understand what the secret of his success was back then? Was it he was just a kind of the ordinary guy that everybody kind of liked? I understand he did have quite good timing, even if his jokes were pretty useless.
Yeah, they say that about a lot of comics, don't they? That, you know, technically he was the comics comic and technically he was very good. And certainly back then, you know, his films with Bing Crosby, you know, the Road to films, they did very well, but even then they started to get tired. And he was always, you get the sense, even at the time, Bob Hope was trying to get more attention and more credit for himself than his talent really deserved. You know, he angled to get himself the Congressional Gold Medal. Well, that's something that, you know, you don't ask for, it's given to you. And once you go out there looking for it, you're seen to be trying to angle a better deal for yourself. Then when at first, eventually they did give him the Congressional Gold Medal, but they refused him at first. And when they said no to that, he said, well, all right, can I have the Nobel Peace Prize instead? And he wasn't joking. I mean, you know, that was a time when one of his non-jokes wasn't funny. And a lot of the time he's, you know, people can go and look at those films now and see if they find them funny. I doubt whether many people would now. Certainly not in the way that Laurel and Hardy do. You know, I've got a young son. We took him to a party a while ago where there were kids of all ages there, from toddlers up to teenagers. And the way that people dealt with them at the party was they put them in a room with a Laurel and Hardy DVD. And all those kids just sat there and lapped it up. It was absolutely timeless. They wouldn't say that about a Bob Hope film.
Well, Hope, Entertainer of the Century, there's another modest title, is out. It's by Richard Zoglin. It's out now and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And to round things off, let's talk about keeping fit. The Temple of Perfection, A History of the Gym, is a new book by Eric Schelin, which documents its past, which dates back almost 2,800 years, drawing on social, economic and spiritual influences it's had in that time. This book, on first glance, you would imagine it was just going to be rather superficial, but it's quite an intriguing book about, I guess, how people have wanted to look, the world of, you know, the perfection in how our bodies appear, and tracing some intriguing elements of the gym.
It is. It's probably a book that's a bit too serious at points, where there's a bit too much history in there. But
you'd like a bit of a workout guide at the back, would you?
Absolutely, yeah. That's what I was sitting there in my leotard waiting for, and it just didn't come along. As you say, the author... he's a personal trainer himself, but he's obviously a big history buff as well. And so it takes us right the way back to the ancient Greeks. And it's from the ancient Greeks that we actually get the word gym, because the Greek word gymnos, G-Y-M-N-O-S, means naked, which is how the Greeks used to train. And the social history is incredible at points. But although they trained naked back then, in ancient Greeks, and the time of the ancient Greeks, it was not seen as fashionable for a man to have a large penis. Now, we'll let listeners decide whether that's the case nowadays or not. But back then, you used to have to tie the penis up when you were exercising. There's lots of sort of incredible stuff like that. And they used to have guys playing flutes to accompany proceedings, which I suppose is the modern equivalent of having Bruno Mars on your iPod. Then, bizarrely, in the 4th century, Christians banned gyms. In fact, they banned all athletics. Which you might say is a bit ironic looking back now from modern times, when the gym is most people's place of, or a lot of people's place of worship. You know, I think a lot of people these days use the gym as, it's almost like their religion, keeping fit, and going to the gym is their sort of attending a church. And then right up to the modern day, there's incredible stuff in there. That once a Jane Fonda's workout video, incredibly famous and successful workout video back in the early 80s. Such was the success of that people were doing aerobic exercises, high impact aerobics moves that they learnt in that video, in normal gyms, which didn't have sprung floors, and they were injuring themselves. So lots of gyms had to change their floors just because of Jane Fonda. It's an incredible story.
I shouldn't just be looking at the pictures, but there are two good pictures in here. There's a picture of a gentleman, a vaudeville strongman who lived from 1867 to 1925. And he was called Eugen Sandow. And I can't tell you the size of his penis because he's got a fig leaf on. But it does kind of point out that he kind of managed to sell kind of semi-erotic pictures of himself to both men and female admirers. But then you cut to what the example of, like, well, I'm not sure it was the perfect, but the biggest gym body you could get many years later. And I would imagine a bit of steroids has been involved here.
Is this the one on page 136?
That's the gentleman, Ronnie Coleman.
Oh, it's a terrifying picture, that.
And there I think we can agree things are a bit out of scale.
They certainly are. Although I still think the truth is, my favourite fact about gyms is not a fact actually that was in this book. I just happened to have read it a few years ago and I made a note of it. That in the UK, the average gym member covers 468 miles each year, but the average dog walker covers 676 miles each year. So, and I'm constantly saying to my partner, she's one of those people that joins gyms the whole time, goes twice and then never goes again. And I say to her, why don't you just take the dog out for a walk? And then you end up in ridiculous situations, like the gym she's a member of currently is about, I don't know, about 10 minutes drive away. And she said, would you give me a lift to the gym? So to which I initially said, well, why don't you just walk to the gym and back? It'll save you the cost of the gym membership. But but then she wanted to go to the gym, so I gave her a lift. And then there was heavy traffic for the final 200 yards. And so she was going to have to get out and walk the final 200 yards to the gym. And she complained about it.
Well, I think that the dog is the solution. I have dog and a gym membership, so I'm pretty good in there.
Foot in both camps. Yeah.
Hero, hey? Well, thank you so much. But first of all, that's The Temple of Perfection. It's a history of the gym. It's by Eric Schelling, and it's out now, and it's published by Reaction Books. But Mark, thank you very much for joining us. The things you discover here on the Arts Review. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when Robert Baum will be joined by film critic Jason Solomons. But for the time being, thanks for listening.